Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of October. The current issue of Mother Jones magazine has some tough questions for future policy in Iraq. The editors of the magazine say that everyone who is running for or holding national office must be forced to answer these questions. What's your schedule for withdrawal, and what consequences do you foresee? Which comes first, withdrawal, a functioning Iraqi government, or a solid international peacekeeping force? What concessions would you make to get Iraq's neighbors to help? What degree of bloodshed are you prepared to stand by and watch? They put that question to a number of military people, think tankers, peace activists, academics, and politicians, and their responses are included in the magazine. There's also a very interesting piece written by our guest this part of this show. Robert Dreyfus is with us. His piece is Post-U.S. Scenarios, the Bad, the Worse, and the Ugly. Robert says that we need to let the wishful thinking out of the way. Peace will not break out if and when the United States leaves Iraq. Violence will continue and possibly get worse. That's not a rationale for leaving the troops in place, just a hard reality. How bad exactly will it be? He proposes four scenarios ranging from the horrific to the somewhat hopeful, and we'll be talking about those with Robert, the first hour of our program today. He's been working as an independent journalist specializing in magazine features, profiles, and investigative stories in the areas of politics and national security. He was profiled as a leading investigative journalist by the Columbia Journalism Review. He's won a number of awards for his work, including Project Censored's first prize for a story on the role of oil in the U.S. policy toward Iraq. He's been writing for Rolling Stone for at least a decade. He covers national security for Rolling Stone's National Affairs section. He's a contributing editor at The Nation, a contributing writer at Mother Jones, and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He is best known for what he considers to be groundbreaking stories about the war in Iraq, the war on terrorism, and post-9/11 U.S. foreign policy. And in 2002, he wrote the first significant profile of Ahmad Shalabi by a journalist for The American Prospect. We'll be welcoming phone calls. It's been a while since we have talked about Iraq. We will today. Our number for on-air participation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Robert. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Let's start with a little bit of what the editors said here, U.S. out of Iraq, how. It's not the administration that it has its head in the sand. We all do to varying degrees. Our consciences, and this is what General Anthony Zinni said, are not clean because we're peace demonstrators. In other words, just because you weren't in favor of going in doesn't mean you're not responsible for what happens when we pull out.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I should say I'm speaking for myself and not
right
for the magazine. I think the issue about Iraq, to me, is pretty clear that the United States needs to get out and do that as soon as possible. So what I was trying to address in my piece here is if we do, I'd love to say when we do, but that's probably too optimistic. If we do, you know, what is Iraq going to look like after the occupation? And I think there's a lot of doomsaying about what would happen if we leave Iraq. Most of the doomsaying comes from people who want us to stick around. You can speculate as well as I can about why people want to stay in Iraq. I think it has nothing to do with humanitarian concerns, just like I don't think the original invasion had much to do with human rights in Iraq. It had all to do with American strategic position in the Persian Gulf, where all the world's oil is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think that the role of the United States is to be the policeman of the Gulf and to be the stabilizing force and basically run that part of the world, then of course you don't want to leave Iraq, and of course you're going to come up with all sorts of doom and gloom scenarios about what's going to happen if we leave, and there's certainly no shortage of those. But what I find is, the more you look at who's spouting those doom and gloom scenarios, they tend to be people who want to stay in Iraq, who think that the United States has to stay there for 10 or 15 years or more, perhaps, you know, indefinitely with permanent bases. because that's the civilizing mission of the American military overseas. I don't agree with that.
The phrase that you hear from those who want us to stay, I'm running the risk of oversimplification, but this is what you hear. We can't leave. If we leave, it will be much worse. It will be a regional war. There will be a genocide. People will be killed in huge numbers. That's the general kind of comment that you hear in favor of not leaving.
Right. Well, of course, it's easy to say, first of all, that that's what's happening now. People are being killed in huge numbers, and there have been at least several hundred thousand Iraqis who've died in the past 4.5 years as a result of the war, not to mention the coalition forces. And, of course, not to mention the millions of people in that country who've been displaced and the catastrophic effects of the war on children. Nearly all of the Iraqi children that are growing up are going to be traumatized for the next generation or more by growing up, you know, during 5 years at least of wartime. So the catastrophic consequences have already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So could it get worse? Well, sure, it could get worse. Anything could get worse. But I think we need to be suspicious of the people who tell us that if the United States leaves, there'll be genocide, because they have an ulterior motive. And after all, most of these people, like the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal editorials and the neoconservatives in Washington at their think tanks, these are the people who wanted us to go in the first place and who told us the exact opposite, that by going in, Iraq would be peaceful and calm, and there would be, you know, that we'd be greeted with flowers as liberators, and we could install a functioning democracy, like, you know, replacing a computer chip. You take Saddam out and you put Shalabi in and everything keeps functioning. Well, we learned that that wasn't true, and so there's at least reason to be suspicious of the people who are telling us the opposite now, because, as I said, they have in mind a permanent American presence in Iraq, which, after all, has, as much as one-fourth of the entire world's oil under the ground there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vast, I think it was Paul Wolfowitz who said that Iraq is floating on a sea of oil. And under the desert, it's very easy to get that oil out. It's cheap. It's immensely profitable. So I think that we should take our chances and leave. And therefore, you know, what could happen? Well, yes, it's possible that the Sunni and Shia factions of the Iraqi Arabs would fall to fighting a civil war immediately. I don't think that's true as the most likely result. And even if they did, unless Iraq's neighbors were to intervene, that they don't really have enough arms and, you know, heavy weapons and so forth to carry the war into the other's territory.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the ethnic cleansing, a great deal of it, has happened already. Certainly more could happen. But I think the Iraqis have an immense incentive to prevent that from happening. I think they have an immense incentive all across the spectrum to prevent the worst from happening. So I think the chances are more likely that some sort of rough stability could emerge, not immediately and not after, not without some remaining bloodshed.
How important is this oil business? You write in one of the scenarios that Iraq's oil wealth, and you just said it, is so significant here, so that the wells, the pipelines, the refineries, the shipping terminals can't withstand civil war, and everybody wants a piece of that pie. Everybody does. Surrounding countries, China, the United States, Japan, everybody wants it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, inside the country, you know, the oil is what makes the economy work. And so if there's a civil war that destroys the oil installations, or at the very least makes them incapable of exporting oil, then Iraq becomes instantly a, a, a poverty-stricken nation. So the even the most corrupt and venal Iraqi politicians know that they can't stay on the gravy train if the oil doesn't continue to flow. And for the more honest politicians and nationalists and people who want the best for Iraq, they too know that, that avoiding civil war means everything, because you can't have an economy without the oil pumping.
Mm-hmm.
But also from the outside, all of the rest of these countries in the world, especially the Asian countries that are developing fast, like China and India, need vast amounts of oil now for their economies. And Iraq is pretty much the only place in the entire world, I should say, that can expand production, not right away, not under conditions of war, but let's say over the next 5 to 7 years, can expand production enough to satisfy a great deal of that demand. The United States isn't going to need much more oil than we already get. In fact, probably through conservation measures, we could begin to reduce the amount of oil we use. But that's not true among the developing countries, because they're just beginning to develop roads and highways and cars and motorcycles and industry and so forth, all that stuff that consumes a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the world has a tremendous interest in stabilizing Iraq, too, and I think they'd be more than happy to come in and help Iraq rebuild once the war ends. You see already that Iraq, the current government of Iraq, just signed a massive billion-dollar deal with China to develop one of its oil fields. And that's while the American troops are occupying the country. Some American, think tank types have said, well, this is a huge double cross. The Iraqis, we're trying to help them out, and they signed a deal with China. Well, the Iraqis will sign a deal with anybody who's willing to come in there and help rebuild the country.
Let's talk a little bit about the government. If we leave, my reading of this is that the government is not functioning very well. So if we're out of there, we got a government that doesn't seem to function. How can you leave a country where you don't have a strong functioning government? And what is it that the rest of the world can do to help build a strong functioning government?
Yeah, well, this current Iraqi government, I think, will immediately disappear, collapse, if the United States leaves. A lot of these people in the government are people that we brought in when we invaded Iraq. And as Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski says, no liberal. I mean, he's a conservative who was President Carter's national security guy. He says that the only people who want us to stay in Iraq are the people who'd have to leave when we leave.
Yeah.
This current government, exiles and religious party leaders and so forth, I'm not sure that they have a strong political base in the country. So the current government will disappear, and there'll have to be a new government emerging on the wreckage of that one. There's already beginning signs of that happening as different parties and politicians leave the government. It's been abandoned now by all of the Sunnis. It's been abandoned by Muqtada Sadr's party. It's been abandoned by the Fadila party called the Virtue Party. They've also pulled out all of their ministers and members of parliament and so forth. So really what's left is a little shell of a government which is kind of creeping along under Maliki, under Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. So I think it's fair to say we'd have to have a new government and a new constitution that would be much more inclusive and that would bring in a much bigger way some of these new Sunni forces that the United States has started to work with in Anbar, the tribal awakening, it's called, perhaps bring in some of the resistance and former Ba'athist groups on the Sunni side, perhaps bring in a much stronger contingent from Muqtada Sadr's group on the Shia side. And in fact, in the last year or so, the Sunnis and the Sadr forces have been reaching out to each other, have been quietly conducting a reconciliation dialogue outside the government, without government participation, have started to talk about bringing Sunni and Shia together. And they're in turn talking with some other members of the Iraqi parliament, including the secular forces, to bring about a new, you know, have a vote of no confidence in the Maliki government and to bring it down and to create a more nationalist government in its mm-hmm. place.
And do you think we would have to have that government in place before we exited?
No, not at all. I think that the problem is the catch-22 in Iraqi politics is that any government, any politician that the United States support has no credibility because it's then seen as an agent of the occupiers.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody we endorse, it's kind of like, you remember that guy, that crazy Ku Klux Klan guy in Louisiana, David Duke?
Sure.
Anybody he would endorse for president, you know, wouldn't exactly embrace David Duke's endorsement, right? And it was sort of a the government that emerges has to be seen as independent of the United States, not installed by, put in place by the United States. And in fact, the most popular politicians in Iraq today, like Sadr, are the ones who are opposing us, who are arguing that the United States has to leave. And I should add, by the way, that the nationalists in Iraq, people like the Sunni resistance forces and many of the Sunni parties and the Sadr Shia and the Fadila party and many others, they're also united by two other things besides their opposition to the United States. They're opposed to al-Qaeda very strongly, and they're opposed to Iran. They don't want to see Iran take a dominant role in Iraq once the United States leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So on all those three things, opposition to the American occupation, opposition to al-Qaeda, opposition to Iran, there's a lot of consensus in Iraq. And the weird, strange paradox of our 4.5 years in Iraq is that we are supporting, in Baghdad, politicians that are the most pro-Iranian of all the political parties in Iraq. It's so strange because you hear the president and the vice president all the time talking about how Iran is a threat and Iran is trying to undermine us in Iraq and kill American soldiers. But the closest politicians to Iran in Iraq are the same ones that we're supporting. People like the Abdulaziz Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, who is one of the most powerful Shia politicians, or Jalal Talabani, who's a Kurdish leader and the president of Iraq. These are people who spent decades living in Tehran before the American invasion, who hobnobbed with the Ayatollahs in Iran for many, many years, who got support and arms and training from them and so forth. So this is a strange and weird paradox.
Robert Dreyfus is our guest. He's author of a piece in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine, Post-U.S. Scenarios, the Bad, the Worse, and the Ugly, Scenarios for a Post-Occupation Iraq. And he is an independent journalist who has been working for a number of publications. He has written for Rolling Stone for at least a decade. He's a contributing editor at The Nation, contributing writer at Mother Jones, senior correspondent for American Prospect. And his work focuses on really groundbreaking stories. He's best known for groundbreaking stories about the war in Iraq, the war on terrorism, and post-9/11 U.S. foreign policy. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, and we're welcoming your phone calls in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Democratic presidential contender Barack Obama said last week the head of the Justice Department's Voting Rights Division should be fired for saying voter ID laws hurt the elderly but aren't a problem for minorities because they often die before old age. Obama also criticized Tanner for clearing a Georgia law that requires voters to show government-issued photo IDs at the polls. In response, A Justice Department spokesperson said Mr. Tanner is an attorney who works to protect civil rights on a daily basis. Nothing in his comments deviated from his firm commitment to enforce the law, and it is unfortunate that they have been so grossly misconstrued. We'll try to get to the bottom of this, the second hour of our program today. All right, let's go to phone calls now. One line is open if you've been trying to get through. We also want to give you, I forgot to do this because it's something semi-new. You can also send us emails in case you can't get to the phone, but you are at a computer. So if you'd like to comment via email, it's WPR.org, WPR.org. 800-486-8655 is the number. Dave from Madison is our first caller, Robert. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to say, listening to your guest, let me agree with him on one thing. There is a lot of work to do. This is a very, this democracy, this country of Iraq, this sovereign nation is just in its infant stages. So I will agree with him that, their government, their parliament, the leaders of their country, there's a lot of work to do, and they need to figure some things out there. But it would be irresponsible. It would be a terrible thing to just leave and let them try and work it out when the security is still a little unstable. Now, and especially with all the news coming out of Iraq, I mean, I saw something where violence is down 70%. I mean, what the people of Iraq need to feel is they need to feel security. And when they start to have positive things happen to their, and they start to see things finally being reconstructed and their infrastructure working and the electricity, getting up to 100%. And when they get these bad people out of there, and when these people start to feel good about what's going on in that country, then and only then will their government, maybe start to figure out where they can, put the oil money and start to figure out the little things on their government. But to just leave and let them try and figure it out, that would be, I disagree with your guest tremendously.
All right, Robert.
Well, what your caller just said is a formula for staying in Iraq for 100 years. I don't think it's remotely possible for all of that to happen without a massive long-term American presence. The Iraqis have a lot to work out, but the last thing we need to do is to argue that we need to stay in Iraq until everything is up and running. We can claim victory, if you like, that we got rid of the dictator, but we're not responsible for putting Humpty Dumpty together again. There's the whole rest of the world out there willing to step in. Iraq's neighbors have a responsibility, and they have tremendous influence over the Iraqi political factions there. And none of Iraq's neighbors, and I stress none of them, has any interest in Iraq disintegrating or falling apart. So they would have a lot of interest in moving in with their proxies and their allies inside the country, the Saudis with the Sunnis, the Iranians with the Shia. The Turks, of course, have a tremendous interest in what's happening in the Kurdish areas, as we've seen in the last few days. All of those countries are actually working together, believe it or not, meeting regularly to talk about how to put Humpty Dumpty together again.
What about the financial responsibility we may face here? What do you think about that, Robert? You mentioned children earlier, and have been struck by reports I've seen of the number of refugee children who simply aren't in school anymore from Iraq. They've been out of school. They're working at, at restaurants, et cetera, or wherever they can in the countries that are taking them in. There are a lot of kids who have been out of school for years in Iraq. Do we, because it's broken so badly, what about building up hospitals and schools and electricity, et cetera? Don't we bear some of that responsibility?
Well, I have no problem at all with the United States taking the lead in creating an international fund to help rebuild Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But not if that fund is aimed at somehow securing American primacy in Iraq, that we're the biggest and best and most important ally of Iraq and all of that kind of nonsense. I think, the world doesn't operate, unfortunately, on a charity basis. There are all kinds of people starving to death all over the world in Africa and Asia. Enormous problems of people not having housing and clean drinking water and access to health care. And you don't see the rest of the world stepping in to help those people. It's a sad fact of the way the world is organized. But Iraq has something that all of the rest of the world wants, which is oil. And so I think you would see, under the guise of we really care about Iraqis, you would see that Japan and China and India and Europe and many other countries would love to step in and help rebuild Iraq because they want some, you know, cut of Iraq's oil exports.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to get favor, curry favor with an Iraqi government.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we can bemoan the way the world works, but the fact is that Iraq is an enormous prize, and there's no oil-consuming country in the world that wouldn't want to get in there and help put it together.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Don is next from New Auburn. Hi, Don.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I agree with your guest there. If you turned it around and put foreign troops in our country, would we want them to stay? You'd have to be a lunatic to think like that. That's just Bush's propaganda. They're trying to keep the war going so they can buddy the hands of the next administration and say, you're just as guilty as we are. These people have to be charged with war crimes for starting this march. They said they were going to hug and kiss us. Everything they told us is a lie.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. What about the response, the Democratic response to this? I mean, the American people, I think, really want to move in some other direction, Robert. They don't think it's working. In huge numbers, they don't think it's working, and they want a new scenario. And I'm wondering, who's going to present this? Or do we wait for another administration to come in and then get another scenario? It seems like a long time to wait for something better.
Well, the Democratic issue is very complicated. I have to say that I agree with your caller just now that the invasion of Iraq was not just a mistake, but it was a war crime. And we invaded a nation and destroyed it, literally ground it to pieces, dissolved its army, its police force, destroyed all of its institutions, destroyed its infrastructure, crippled its oil industry, everything. In the pursuit of some maniacal goal, and that constitutes, I think, the first time in history that we've ever invaded a country that had not attacked us, and for no reason other than greed. What are the Democrats going to do about that? I don't think there's any great sign that the Democrats are advocating a radical change in our Iraq policy. I think there's a beginning to be a consensus among moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats that Iraq is a long-term American project. Now, I totally disagree with that notion, and I think certainly there are some Democrats who are much, much stronger in their opposition from the Out of Iraq and Anti-War Caucus in the House to people like Russ Feingold and I mean, you can go down the list and name the people who've spoken out. Even John Edwards has been pretty outspoken,
mm-hmm.
as well as Governor Richardson from New Mexico. But the consensus that's emerging among moderate Democrats is to try to keep, you know, 30, 50, 60,000 troops there for a number of years. I don't think there's any reason to think either that is going to work or B, that it's necessary. But I think that's why you're not seeing the Democrats really standing up. They're way behind where the public is.
Right.
The public, when you do polling,
right.
Says something like, you know, 70% is around the average, says that we should be out of Iraq within a year.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the Democrats in Congress are not close to that position yet. And it's true. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to their problems in facing a Republican veto, of a presidential veto, and a Republican filibuster in the Senate and so forth. There's a lot of obstacles to overcome. I do think that this latest budget request from the president, which now pushes the total for the war within another $200 billion requested for next year, pushes the total over $800 billion. That is not going to go down easily.
in Congress. I don't think that the Democrats are going to accept that. But this is really, you know, fighting around the margins. So maybe they reduce it by a few billion or tens of billion. The political forces in Washington are just not aligned
right. To
force a change in our Iraq policy.
Even though $800 billion is almost a trillion dollars.
It's so much money that nobody can, you know, grasp the amount. I mean, the Democrats, some of the Democrats lately have pointed out that the children's health program that the president just vetoed, the total cost of that was over 5 years, $35 billion. So, in other words, the amount of money that we spend in Iraq in just a few weeks would have covered the entire
right. Children's
health program for 5 years.
Right.
And, you know, you can come up with your list of what we could be doing with $800 billion, but it would pretty much allow us to rebuild our entire bridge and highway system in this country, provide everybody without health insurance to get health insurance, and could probably pay for free college education for every American, as well as free pre-kindergarten school for parents who want to send their kids to pre-K education. So, I mean, this is an unbelievably staggering amount of money.
Yes, it is. We have
and it's being thrown down a black hole.
Yeah. We have an email from Joe from River Falls. I'm concerned that the administration will convince or force the Iraqi government to motivate combat operations against Iran. With that, of course, we would be forced to fight with them or for them. Is this possible or worse, probable?
Well, the funny thing is that it's the Iraqis. I heard an Iraqi official who was just in Washington, I went to see him the other day, saying that an attack on Iran would be the worst possible catastrophe for Iraq, and he's absolutely right. The Iraqi officials are very pro-Iran. You know, Prime Minister Maliki goes to Tehran all the time. He meets with Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the supreme leader. He meets with President Ahmadinejad. They have visited Iraq. Iranian officials have been in Iraq quite frequently when they're not arrested by American forces there. And so it's really just the Bush administration that is trying to build up Iran as the boogeyman. Part of the conflict, of course, has to do with the Iranian nuclear program. Now they've layered on top of that since January when the surge started. And the president said, I've authorized our commanders, he said this back in January, to go after Iran, you know, inside Iraq. Well, the fact is, if we attacked Iran, not only would it lead to further chaos in the region, but it would induce the Iranians to cause us untold grief inside Iraq. And that's why most of the American military commanders, I'm talking about Admiral Fallon, who's the head of Central Command, as well as Admiral Mullen, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are strongly opposed to attacking Iran because they know that the American troops in Iraq are vulnerable to Iran inciting the Shia to attack us. And if the Sunni insurgency was bad, a Shia insurgency would be incalculable, because that's 60% of the country.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Robert Dreyfus is our guest this hour. He's a journalist and author. His most recent work, Post-U.S. Scenarios, The Bad, The Worse, and The Ugly, Scenarios for a Post-Occupation Iraq, is in the October issue of Mother Jones Magazine. And the scenarios are Apocalypse Now, Mad Max, Partition, and Let's Make a Deal. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Don from New Auburn, thanks for your call. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls at 800-486-8655. Aaron from Egg Harbor is next. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm enjoying the article myself in the Mother Jones. I believe that we could get out of there as quick as we got in there, one day to a month, and that would be plenty of time for the other countries to align themselves. But one more point, on page 34, there's a soldier there that looks just like Elvis, and I do Elvis impersonations too, and he should be here doing shows.
There's a soldier who in the magazine?
Yeah,
a picture?
Page 34.
Huh, I don't have it. I just have a print copy of the magazine. Robert?
You know, everybody should be back here, all those American soldiers, doing what they do best, which is living their lives. And I think that part of the reason you've seen the public turn against the war in the last year and a half or so, 2 years, at least according to the polls, is that there have been so many funerals in small towns all over this country. It's the small rural America that has been, unfortunately, the people who supplied the cannon fodder to the army to send over to Iraq. And as those people are killed, several thousand of them, obviously, these are huge stories in these small towns because it's the high school quarterback and the prom queen who are being killed in Iraq, and they are well known in these little towns. And if you look at the recent polls, you see in the most hardcore Republican stronghold, which is rural America, you see that President Bush's support has completely collapsed in that part of the country, and that is the last place you'd think would turn against the president. And a large part of it is that these, you know, farmers and auto mechanics and the Elvis impersonators are being sent over to Iraq and being killed.
Did you have anything else, Aaron?
No, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Kathy is next from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If the project for the new American century is to be believed, we are basically, I think, we're in a war for empire. And the fact that 3,800 young people, young and middle-aged people, have died over there, that's our forces. How many thousands of Iraqis, and we don't even keep count of them, it seems that the government is possibly just willing to write those off and say that's the cost of empire. And when England had its own empire, that was part of the cost of doing business. You're going to bleed a few, and, well, that's tough, but, hey, we have to have our empire. Am I just being terribly cynical or what?
Robert.
Well, you know, you can argue over the technical definition of an empire, but there's simply no question in my mind that by going into Afghanistan and Iraq, we've created literally hundreds and hundreds of bases and outposts, and we've owned and occupied two major countries in the most oil and gas rich part of the world, Central Asia and the Persian Gulf. And this is all about American influence. It isn't just profits for the oil companies and profits for defense companies. That's byproduct. The real point of the American presence in Iraq is that it puts us right in the middle of the action, and it makes it harder for countries like China and Russia that are big energy powers and consumers and producers of energy to get access to that part of the world. So it's really about getting a chokehold over the most important energy-producing part of the world. And everybody knows that if Iraq produced only dates, which is, I think, one of its other major exports, we would never have invaded the country in the first place.
Do you see, though, a major difference between Iraq and Afghanistan, that Afghanistan was legitimate because, you know, that's where the guys were who did us wrong, big wrong, and so we had to rout them out. We had to get rid of the Taliban. You see a difference there or not?
I see certainly big differences between Iraq and Afghanistan, but you may have noticed that we didn't get rid of the Taliban.
Right, we didn't. No.
We took a poor, impoverished country with no army. We invaded the capital of the country, namely Kabul. We put in power a guy named Karzai, who nobody in Afghanistan had ever heard of. We tried to bring the king back, by the way, and that didn't work. And as a result,
not only did we not create democracy, but we simply created another civil war. I don't think, you know, the Taliban are not my best friends. I don't like them. But we can't go to war against countries because we want women to go to school. That's just an insane way of doing a foreign policy. We should have negotiated with the Taliban and given them whatever they wanted in order for them to turn over bin Laden to us. And there were hints that that might have been able to happen. We could have left the Taliban in place but gotten al-Qaeda dismantled. And, you know, maybe with some military action, of course, to underline that and to get back at some of the al-Qaeda camps and things like that. But the fact is, if Afghanistan has a government that is ugly and repressive and doesn't let women go to school and so forth, that's not a reason to invade and topple the government. That's nuts.
Kathy, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Habu from Madison. Hello.
Good morning, and very interesting conversation. Just very quickly, 2 points. I like what you write, Mr. Dreyfus, and have read this for many years, and I remember you were quite on the money when before this invasion occurred. However, I find problems with a couple of points, but I'll just mention one, and that is that we can't put Humpty Dumpty back again, and yes, in a general way we can't, but having gone there uninvited against the UN authority and completely dismantled this country, having broken it and the social fabric, more importantly, we have a moral obligation to apologize, but that's very little, rebuild the physical infrastructure and pay reparations and do it in a very, very public way, in hiring Iraqis, etc. Now, we can't let the rest of the world put this on the shoulders of the rest of the world, because the rest of the world, except Britain and the other Palau and some other tinpot dictators or countries who are involved. This is not the obligation of India or the Gulf states, because they had no nothing to do with it. And the second very quick point is, the rest of the other countries to send forces there to stabilize the Iraq, that goes back to the British Raj, where, you know, the colored boys were the foot soldiers to go and put their lives on the line after America has wreaked this havoc. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Habu.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what your caller said, and I certainly agree that America has the moral responsibility for having destroyed Iraq. We owe the country something. I certainly agree that it's partly the onus is on the United States to pay for the rebuilding of this country. As far as an apology goes, sure, I agree with that. But, you know, the world doesn't work on moral principles. I'm sad to say that, but it's just a fact. It works on cold, hard calculations by nations that pursue their interests. And so the American government is pursuing what it sees as its interest in Iraq now. And the only way that is going to change is when it's forced to change. And, you know, gradually the American establishment is coming around to realizing that we lost this war and we're being forced to change to a new policy. I guess I don't think that moral responsibility includes to us maintaining a military presence to try to help rebuild Iraq. I think that's something that Iraqis are going to have to step up and do themselves, and I have enough confidence in Iraqis that they can do it. But yes, they're going to need vast amounts of financial and economic help from the rest of the world. And for cold, hard, calculating reasons, I think other countries will step in to do that because, as I said before, they want Iraq's oil. So I think that the Iraqis who want to rebuild their country can take advantage of that. There's a lot of nationalism in this country. That's one of the reasons I think that this partition idea that Senator Biden has put forward is so bad, because he proposes basically, you know, carving up the country into three little states. Nobody in Iraq wants that, except for perhaps a majority of the Kurds in the north. But the Kurds themselves, they're pretty realistic. They know they can't really have an independent state because, for one thing, the Turks won't allow it. So I think that the Iraqis themselves don't want to partition the country. And so it's very dangerous for somebody like Senator Biden, who I have to say just doesn't know what he's talking about, to go around proposing, you know, carving up Iraq like he's some latter-day Churchill who's going to redraw the map of the Middle East. It's none of his business.
We welcome more phone calls. A couple lines are open if you've been trying to reach us. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus. His piece in the current issue of Mother Jones, Post-U.S. Scenarios, the Bad, the Worse, and the Ugly Scenarios for a Post-Occupation Iraq. Ned from Wausau is next. Hi, Ned.
Hi.
Hi.
I agree a lot with your guest. I think he's excellent. And I would like to remind people that this idea of having a victory in Iraq is never really defined by the administration, and I just don't see how it's even possible to have a victory in Iraq. And I think it's very important that people realize we'll be there for decades if we don't withdraw. We must withdraw, and it needs to be over a fairly short time span, because this idea of winning is just simply idealistic thinking. Reality needs to set in. And the reality is, yes, there will be a civil war, even larger than we have today, when we leave. But that would happen even if it's 10 years from now, or if it's 20 years from now, or if it's 50 years from now. There is going to be a massive civil war, and we just can't avoid the fact that the current government of Iraq exists within the green zone. And without the green zone of our protection, it would fold in a minute. So that government is just not a legitimate government, and we need to change the situation, and the best thing to do is stop wasting massive numbers of lives and dollars and come home in the shortest time frame possible.
Thank you, Ned, for your call. It is hard to, if not almost impossible, to imagine victory, isn't it, Robert?
I don't think that even the American armed forces right now are thinking about victory in Iraq. It's even difficult to get, when you ask people, you know, to get a sense of who we're fighting. Is it the is it the Sunnis? Is it the Shia? Which Shia? Which Sunnis? You know, who's on our side? Who's against us? We're kind of just, you know, scrambling around trying to figure out, you know, how to hold the country together. I don't agree with one thing that your caller said, which is that if we leave, there's going to be a civil war. It is not preordained. There's a level of civil war right now, but it is not preordained that it'll get worse if we leave. In fact, as I was saying at the beginning of the show, you can just as well argue that it'll get much better if we leave, not instantly and not, you know, sweetness and light break out instantly, but the idea that if we leave, there'll be an apocalypse is simply not true. That's a possibility. But we shouldn't, as we make our plans to withdraw, assume that that's something that's guaranteed.
Another thought to email from Amy from Madison. My politics are diametrically opposed to neocon Republicans. I want us to leave Iraq as quickly as possible and with as little further loss of life. But I also strongly believe we must take responsibility for our reckless behavior and the chaos and bloodshed it has unleashed upon the population, to shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, there will be violence if we stay and violence if we go, so let's go and not look back, is as immoral as the lies of the neocons that got us into this mess in the first place. Thanks for your comments, Amy. Let's go next. Ned, thanks for your call. Jan from Madison, we're very short on time. Hi, Jan.
Hi, I'll be brief. This is an excellent show, and what I'm wondering is, why aren't the Democratic candidates talking about the holding a referendum, letting the Iraqi people speak for what they want? From what I'm hearing, they don't want us there. We don't want us there. And I do agree. We have a responsibility to help rebuild. Why aren't they talking about this?
All right. 15 seconds, Robert.
You know, they should be saying that. And the Democrats should be talking a lot more about what the Iraqis want. But sadly, there's too much pandering to the tough guy attitude that I'm stronger than the next guy and I'm going to fight the terrorists and the bad guys more than the next guy. And the Democrats are falling into that trap.
Thank you, Robert, so much for being with us. It was a good hour. Robert Dreyfus, our guest, his current piece, he writes for a lot of publications, but what we were talking about was based on his piece in Mother Jones for this month, Post-U.S. Scenarios, the Bad, the Worse, and the Ugly, Scenarios for a Post-Occupation Iraq. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios. And thanks, everybody, for your calls and your emails. Another good hour ahead. Please stay with us for a story that I think's been underreported. So that's coming up. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.